In our last class, I was speaking about the sort of basic characteristics of Le Bris, and I thought what I would do this time is to describe just what Le Bris was like when I was there in Switzerland in the year 1967, the summer of 67 to the summer of 68. That would be perhaps the best way to give you a sort of handle on what the Schaefer's life was actually like, to describe what a normal day was like, to describe what a normal weekend was like, or perhaps I should say an abnormal weekend, because every weekend was abnormal in terms of ordinary life. But just to describe a little bit of the situation there, just to give you some idea of what they were actually doing. Now, I've got here at the beginning just a map, a very primitive map of this part of Switzerland. This is the Rhone Valley here, and the train line goes down to Italy towards Milan. If you go down that way, you end up going through one of the passes down into Italy. Back this way is the Lake of Geneva and Lausanne and Geneva itself and Monterey. Now, here is the little village they lived in originally, the village of Champéry in the canton of Valais. Over here, the canton of Vaud, the Protestant canton. And these are some of the towns which appear again and again in any of the stories if you are reading either Mrs. Schaefer's book, The Le Bris Story, or The Tapestry, or any of the other. This is the town of Aigle, down in the village, down at the bottom of the valley. A little town named Olonne, which you come up through on the road. And then Wemo itself, Wemo-sur-Olonne, that's the name of the little river that comes down this valley. And then the two next towns up, Chezières and Villars. Later, many years later, the Schaefers moved into a house up here in Chezières. This town is situated somewhere somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 feet up on the mountainside where they lived. Now, what I want to do, as I said, is to describe what life was like in... you'll have to turn it over and turn it round the other way to get it the right way up. To describe what life was like in Switzerland at that time, in 1967 to 1968. I had just become a Christian a few months before and hitchhiked from England the day after I graduated from university to Switzerland, and arrived there one Saturday in the middle of one of their busy weekends in June 1967. This is a very primitive map. I'm not an artist, but this is a very primitive map of the village of Wemo and of the different Le Bris houses by the summer of 1967. You remember when they first started the work, when they'd been thrown out of Champéry, this was the first house that they bought or put a down payment on. That was Chalet Les Malaises, where the Schaefers themselves lived. Later on, just a couple of years later, they started renting this chalet right next door, Beausite. And by the time I was there in 1967, there were now, I guess it is, 8 houses around the village which Le Bris was using. Chalet Bethany down here, which was on a little road to a village called Panay. A tiny little apartment here at Chalet Rionzi in the very middle of the village, actually right next to the village inn. And then there's this tiny little back road, which was only accessible by car about this far, and then came to a dead end up here. This is Chalet Cineau, where Schaefer's eldest daughter Priscilla lived with her husband John Sandry, and then Chalet Les Sapins, which I mentioned earlier, which they had prayed for way back in 1955-56, but eventually got about 10 years later when it was bought and given to the work of Le Bris, actually by somebody who had worked with Amy Carmichael in India and donor of her fellowship for many years, purchased this chalet for Le Bris, Chalet Les Sapins. When I went there in 67, the Schaefer's youngest daughter, Debbie, was living here with her husband, Udo Middleman. Then there are these two other chalets here. This one, Chezelet, is the chalet which Jane Stuart Smith, the opera singer from Milan, who originally came from Roanoke, Virginia, this was her home and the home of Betty Carlson. The two of them live there together now too, in this house. Betty Carlson's a writer from Illinois, and she and Jane shared this chalet together, Chalet Chezelet, and then they had Chalet Bourdonnet. So you can see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 houses scattered around the village of Wemo. which Le Bris had in 1967. Now let me tell you just a little bit about what it was like. In these houses, I suppose at that time in the summer, there were, during the weeks, anywhere up to about 60 plus people staying, scattered around these different chalets. This was in the summer, up to about 60 people during the week. At weekends, that number could go up to 100 altogether, staying in these different houses. In the winter, when Le Bris was at its quietest point, there were 20 to 30 people staying in these houses during the week, and 30 to 50 at the weekends. But it was an extended and very, very busy summer, because people would start arriving in much bigger numbers any time from sort of April onwards right through till October, November. So a long summer, but very, very busy during that time. People stayed in all these different houses. There were a few people living in Chalet-le-Malez with the Schaeffers. As I mentioned, there was Mrs. Schaeffer's mother, Grandmother Schaeffer. There was Gracie, a woman who had an accident, who was a lovely person, but who had the age of a sort of 10-year-old, who they were looking after. There were a couple of fellows usually staying there, and some bunk beds down in the basement of that house, and usually three or four girls living on the middle floor, along with Gracie. And they, and Frankie, their son, who was about 15 at the time, and grandmother living on the top floor. Chalet Bethany could take up to 20 people, and Sapin sometimes had 20 people, and Bourdonnette and Beausite usually had between 10 and 15 people or so. Rionzi just two or three, and Sino was a tiny little chalet. There was just John and Priscilla and their family there. So all these people scattered around this village, and there were other people sometimes staying in pensions around who would come in to study as well. There were various, spelt just like pension, but pensions, sort of little bed and breakfast places you could stay in around the village, and various people were staying in those too and would come in to study. Different houses around the village and in other villages up the mountain, like Chaisière and Villars. And there was other people constantly coming and going as well who weren't staying. The life of those of us who worked there was made more difficult by the fact that from time to time tourists would arrive and want to see Schaeffer. That happened more later than in 1967, because in 1967 he was just working on his first books. But within 5 years or so, you would get people arriving as sort of tourists to see Le Bris and to see Schaeffer. At that time, in 1967, there weren't really people like that, though there were people all the time just dropping in. Some people would write ahead of time to come. Many people would just turn up to stay there at any time. People were living in these various different houses, and then every day a meal list was put up in a central place at Chalet-le-Malez, and all the people staying would have their different meals at these different houses. So you'd be moved around eating breakfast probably in your own one, the one you were living in, and then lunch and dinner in one of the other chalets. At the beginning, Le Bris only had guests, people who were coming up for weekends or for a few days, and there was no charge for them. And at this time in 1967, there was no charge for guests at all either. Later on, the Schaeffers had people coming who wanted to stay for longer periods of time. A guest could stay for up to 10 days. And that's all there was at first, just people coming as guests, and then one or two people who stayed with the Schaeffers to help them, some of whom became workers, like Dorothy Jameson, I mentioned, who was the first one outside the family who stayed and helped them and then became a worker with them. And of course, those who were staying as helpers or workers, there was no charge at all. In fact, they got basically a very tiny amount of support, a sort of little salary that's developed somewhat since that time, as they've got families working there. They obviously have to be given enough to live on, who get a proper salary today. But at the beginning, they were just getting, especially the helpers, just a little bit of sort of pocket money just to help them. Now, as Le Bris developed, more and more people started coming and wanting to stay for extended periods of time to study. The Schaeffers developed what they called Farrell House, named after the Swiss reformer Guillaum Farrell, who had preached in this part of Switzerland. In fact, if we were to turn the board over, which we don't need to, he preached all up in these villages like Weimar, way back in the 16th century. He was a close associate of Calvin, if you've read your history. But he was a preacher who went around all these little villages preaching the evangelical gospel all through the mountains. And they named their sort of study center after him. Now, when Farrell House was started and people wanted to stay for longer periods than a week or 10 days or a weekend, they started charging a fee for those people, primarily to help them to take their studies seriously. People would stay for 2 weeks, for a month, for 2 or 3 months, and stay to study in depth. Many of those who did that were Christians who wanted to come and really spend some time studying with Schaeffer, thinking with him, working through things. Now, for Farrell House, they charged a fee, and they still do. If somebody comes to Le Brie as a student, rather than a guest for a few days, they are charged a fee towards the cost of their expenses. I estimated in all the years we worked at the English Le Brie, the fee that people paid covered about 15% of the costs of running our branch of Le Brie. The rest of the cost, 85%, still today is completely dependent upon unsolicited gifts from people. And Le Brie today is right back where it was at the very beginning, which was totally dependent month by month on gifts that were given for its ongoing work. In fact, we get letters from our colleagues in England, of course, who write to us, and we pray for them, where we used to be working. And the last 3 months, the whole of Le Brie has been in a position where at the beginning of the month they have not had anything to pay for the bills for that month. And their prayers have been answered very dramatically in the last couple of days of each month for them to be able to pay their bills. That seems a little bigger thing now, when now there are all these families working there, just like at this time, except now there are branches in Holland and Sweden and England and so on as well, as that branch there in Switzerland. But when the Schaeffers started, they were literally scraping the barrel all the time. Each month they just had enough money to pay the bills that came in that month and would do repairs as money came in for them. Well, Le Brie is back in that position now. There was a long period in between sort of 1968, we could say, onwards, up to about 1984, to the time of Schaeffer's death, where Francis and Edith gave all their royalties to Le Brie. And those provided somewhat of a cushion. But even when his books were selling very, very well, at the height of his sort of popularity, one could say, the royalties from the books covered, I think, at the very most, even at the probably the best year for them, about 40% of Le Brie's budget for the year. But they gave their royalties to Le Brie completely. That was a sort of gradually growing amount from this time onwards, 1968 onwards, when the first books were published, up until 1984, 1985. And during that period, when there were all those royalties coming in, because his books sold a great many, many copies, millions of copies here in the States, at that time, Le Brie built up a kind of cushion, I suppose you could say, of finances, which at the furthest period would have meant that if they'd stopped receiving a cent, they would have been able to stay open for, say, 5 or 6 months before the work would have to close completely. But all through that time, they were still really dependent upon gifts, because 5 or 6 months cushion isn't much of a cushion when you've got, you know, a dozen or 15 families who are totally dependent upon this for their livelihood. It's not much security in the quote sort of worldly sense, I suppose you could say. But that was only at the very height of this period of his book selling. Now Le Brie is back at the place where it was at the very beginning, and where it was still in 1967 when I went there, when it had no cushion whatsoever, and every month it exhausted all of its finances, and really is an ongoing demonstration of God's answers to their prayers. And that was a very dramatic thing as a young Christian, coming to see that, coming into a situation where they really were dependent upon gifts coming in, often from people they didn't know, over our years working in the English Le Bris, many of the people who supported Le Bris with gifts, sometimes one-off gifts, sometimes regularly, were people we didn't know at all, but who, of course, we would write to and thank. It's kind of amazing to be supported that way. There's very little regular income. There are a very few people who give every single month to Le Bris that you could sort of count on, and there are very few churches. And even today, the great majority of the gifts that come to Le Bris, I would say, are less than $1,000. And of course, with the size of Le Bris now, it needs a lot of money. I think in England, by the time we left there, it was costing something like $150,000 a year to run the branch, because of all the people working there, all the people staying there. And almost all the gifts are anywhere between, say, $5 and $1,000, mostly on the smaller end of that, which are coming in and supporting this work. Yeah, is Le Bris, are the branches of Le Bris autonomous? That's not an easy question to answer. The Dutch branch has always been completely independent financially. The other branches, you could say, have a degree of independence. There is no autonomy in the strict sense. None of them are a law to themselves, because all of them report their finances every month to Le Bris treasurer, who is Barry Segrin today, who works at the English branch. So everyone is aware of everyone else's financial situation, and the salary of those working in the different branches is made as near as possible equal across the different nations in which Le Bris works, so that everybody is being treated equally. The way Le Bris works, you don't get a salary increase as you're in the year work longer. Somebody who just comes into the work is getting paid the same amount as somebody who's been working there for, say, 15 or 20 years. You're paid on the basis of the number of your children and things like that, according to need, in other words. Rather than a sort of graduated salary scheme. So there is a uniformity of the way finances are dealt with across all the branches, because all the branches of Le Bris are completely interdependent in terms of praying for one another, working together, encouraging one another, meeting together once a year. The members, the directors from the different branches, meet together once a year for a week to pray together and talk about the work. So there is no autonomy in that sense at all. In practice, from day to day, each branch operates with a fair degree of independence. And obviously, each branch is very dependent upon gifts that are given to that branch directly. There isn't an absolute financial independence in that sense, though. If they run short, there is a general fund, because there are people who just give to Le Bris rather than to the English Le Bris or the Swedish Le Bris or the Swiss Le Bris or the American Le Bris. They just give to Le Bris, and there is a general fund there which any of the branches can draw on in need. But most of the finances come to the branches independently, individually, as people pray for their work and support their particular work. Okay, do ask me questions like that as we go along, because it will help me in explaining what was really happening there. Coming back here, we are to 1967, and these houses scattered around the village. I was describing how many people were there. We could move on. Secondly, we've talked about the houses, the number of people there. We could call that point number one here, if you like, scattered around this village. Secondly, just thinking, what kinds of people came? What kinds of people were there when I went there as a very young Christian in the summer of 1967? Well, there were all sorts of people. You couldn't really categorize them as belonging to any particular group. There were quite a few people who were not Christians at all. As that was at the sort of height of the hippie period, there were quite a lot of really what one might call counterculture sort of people who were there. In fact, after I had been there for a couple of weeks, I'll just give you an illustration of one person who came there. After I had been there for a couple of weeks, which was all I'd gone there for originally, I decided that I was going to stay there and work there for a year. And I thought I'd better just go home and tell my parents that that's what I was doing. So I hitchhiked back to England, and explained to my parents what I was going to be doing. In fact, a non-Christian who was at Le Brie came with me, visited my family too. And then I hitchhiked back to Switzerland from England. On the way there, actually in the middle of a cabbage patch near Nancy in France, I ran into a, I guess you could call him a hippie, a sort of counterculture sort of person. He was stealing a cabbage from somebody's field because he didn't have anything to eat. And so we just got talking, and I told him where I was going and invited him to come along with me. And so he came back to Le Brie with me. He was a really wild guy, I can tell you. Really, really wild. But there were all sorts of people there. There were people who were college teachers and lecturers. There were doctors and lawyers. There were dropouts. There were ordinary families. There were people who were young Christians who had all kinds of questions. There were people who were about to give up their Christian faith. There were people with all kinds of emotional and psychological problems. You know, there is always such a mixture of people staying at any branch of Le Brie. It's one of the things that makes the work very challenging if you're working there, that you get such a mixture of people coming, because you can't predict what kind of people you're going to have, what kind of questions they're going to ask, what kind of things they're going to be struggling with personally. And obviously with it, weekends, up to 100 people there at this time in 1967, there was just a huge variety of people. There were quite a few fellows from Africa there that summer when I arrived. There was a group of people who were working in Europe with Operation Mobilization. There were just all sorts of people. People from OM who'd come there to study for a while.
Jim,
yes?
How did they learn about
it? How did people learn about Le Brie? Most of them, you see, at this time there weren't even any books. Most people learned about Le Brie, and still do today, through personal contact with somebody. Like the guy I met in the cabbage patch. I wasn't stealing from the cabbage patch, he was, but like the fellow I met in the cabbage patch. There were many people who just met people in all kinds of ways and would turn up there. I gave an illustration, I think, I can't remember if it was in this class or another class, of when I was there some years later visiting for a Le Brie members meeting, a Le Brie directors meeting. There were two young men from Afghanistan who came from a completely Muslim background and who had come to the conclusion that God was completely different from what they'd been told, and they prayed that God would reveal himself to them. And then a young Australian who'd been at Le Brie in Switzerland was traveling across Asia on his way back to Australia, and he stopped in their village and managed to communicate with them that Le Brie in Switzerland was a place they could go to find out about God. And so they came there, and I met them there. This was in about 1977, and they became Christians there. Well, people came in all kinds of ways from all sorts of different places. Many of them were people who'd run across other individuals in some place. Some came from places back here in the States where maybe there was a teacher at their college who knew about Le Brie, who had a student, who'd started asking questions, and they said, well, here's a place where you can go to get some more answers. You know, Schaefer will help you. There were others who went because somebody in their family had been helped, or somebody in their church had been helped. And so they said, why don't you go there? But it's the same even today. Many people, of course, you get people now going because they've read books, or because they've heard one of the Le Brie members speaking at a conference somewhere. But many people are still going because they've met somebody who's said this is a helpful place to go. And at that time, of course, most of it was by word of mouth. Almost everybody who came would have been baptized by word of mouth. Like, I had heard about it through the person I was converted through at university. He was a Canadian who'd spent some time studying at the Swiss Le Brie. He'd spent a few weeks there between his two of his years at university, where he's doing a PhD in philosophy. He found Schaefer very helpful. He used to play tapes by Schaefer in his apartment on Saturday nights. That's how I was converted. And he encouraged me to go to Switzerland when I graduated. And there were many other people there like that who had become Christians through somebody who had been at Le Brie, just as I had. So just all people coming in all sorts of ways. Yeah, where were we? The kinds of people. Fourthly, what about the schedule? What about the schedule that was taking place there? Schedule, I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm completely lost. Living in another country, you begin to forget how to pronounce any words at all. But what do you say here?
Schedule.
Schedule. Okay, I had it right the first time. Okay. Every Monday was a day of prayer. The day would always start with Edith giving a talk on prayer, which was supposed to be for sort of 20 minutes and would usually be for at least an hour. And then there would be a short time of prayer together, and then everybody would go back to their various jobs or study. If you were coming to La Brea as a student, you would study in Farrell House either for the morning or for the afternoon, and then you would work, you would help with the work needing to be done around the place the other half of the day. I forgot to add one thing on this board here, and this was when I went there. They had just recently had a chapel built, and that had Farrell House was a room in the basement of that chapel where up to a dozen people could listen to tapes at the same time, and where that's where you would go to study. I mean, a dozen, maybe 20 people could study there at a time. People would be there listening to tapes for half of the day, and then helping around in the houses with cooking, with cleaning, with gardening, the other half of each day. But Monday was a day of prayer. After Edith's talk, there was put up a list where everybody would sign up for half an hour or more if they wanted to pray for their own needs and to pray particularly for the work of La Brea and for its needs and for the people staying at it. So every day of prayer had a sort of chain of prayer going through the day. This went right back to the very beginning of La Brea, when Edith had started doing this with her children, dividing the day into half-hour periods like that. If you look in the La Brea story, you'll see a sort of typical day of prayer calendar in here, if I can find it, which Edith always used to produce each Monday morning and put up for people to sign on. It's somewhere in here. I had it earlier. I should have marked the page. Oh, I can show that to you another time. But then you would go about your work or your study, and you'd take your time out to pray specifically for the work of La Brea, and there would be a prayer meeting on the Monday evening after the day, after supper. Usually Tuesday and Thursday there was a lecture or a Bible study in the evening, and then the weekends were incredibly busy. And let me describe a weekend for you. The Schaeffers would have a day off on Fridays, just thinking of their life. They were getting one day off a week. Often it wasn't much of a day off for Schaeffer, because if the weather was good, he would very often go for a walk with people staying at La Brea on his day off. He'd take them for a long hike through the mountains. And sometimes, even if it was her day off, Edith would do extraordinary things for people. Let me just give you an illustration from my own life. Edith has always been a matchmaker, and when she saw that Vicky and I were beginning to get together, my wife was Schaeffer's secretary that year we were there. She was there already working when I arrived in June. And in October, Edith saw that we were beginning to spend a little bit of time together. I was working in the house as Edith's cook and gardener, and my wife was there as his secretary. When she saw we were beginning to get together, she spent half the night before her day off, both the night before and early that day, getting up very early and making us a very special picnic. She thought she would put her little hand in helping us get together. And when we went off for our hike that morning, it was a beautiful day in October. It was actually my birthday, October the 20th. She had prepared to help our romance along the most beautiful picnic lunch you can imagine. She had roasted a little chicken. She had made all kinds of cookies and little cakes and sweetbreads and things like that. She'd put in a cloth tablecloth and cloth napkins and silverware and everything else. She had it all packed up, and this was her contribution to helping us get together. I had great delight in telling her that evening that we actually got engaged the night before. But we appreciated her kindness. But that was her day off. She'd actually got up early to prepare that on. That gives you an idea of the kind of concern for individuals that they were prepared to take, that they always took in their lives. I mean, you couldn't be there without experiencing a real sense of how they treated each person as an individual, how they cared for each one. Now, in terms of the weekends, people would start arriving, masses of them, on Friday evenings. Breakfast Saturday was usually in the house where you were living. And then lunch every Saturday. I would start work on making lunch. You'd have to start right after breakfast because we'd have, say, maybe 20 to 30 for lunch on Saturday. And the other thing I had to do Saturday morning would be to make bread for Edith. Because it was for so many people, there was this huge kitchen table and it would be completely covered in dough when you made bread. It needed somebody who was pretty powerful to be able to knead that amount of dough. Because she would serve everybody for supper on Saturday evening and for Sunday tea. So it was an incredibly busy weekend. She would come up after breakfast Saturday morning and she would give her instructions for what she wanted us to make for lunch. And those were very detailed instructions. If you've ever met Edith Schaefer, if she didn't think that you knew what she was talking about, she would draw exactly what size she wanted carrots chopped and onions chopped and everything else that you were preparing. If she wasn't sure you were going to do just what she wanted, well, after a while, when you got to know her standards, you knew exactly what to do without her doing all that. But she would prepare a very detailed menu. She would then go back down and start working in her office. At this time in 1967, she was writing the Labrie story. And Schaefer was writing The God Who Is There and Escape from Reason. The very first books were sort of in the pipeline at this time. So she would go back down to her office. He would be working upstairs in his office. There was so much going on in their little house all the time. Because it's a wooden chalet, it's very noisy. He would have to play music upstairs all day long to be able to work at all, just to drown out all the noise below, which was coming through these wooden floors. So he played classical music all day long just to enable himself to work. As I said, he was working in his little bedroom where he had a little chair at the end of the bed. On Saturday, he would do some dictation to my wife, who was his secretary then, in the mornings after breakfast. He would spend some time working on his sermon for Sunday, and he'd spend a lot of time talking to people who were there just for the weekend and who had come to see him. About half an hour before lunch, Edith would appear to put the final touches to the lunch, to sort of put it together. We'd have everything prepared and everything ready cooking, and she would come and do the last minute creative things that she wanted to do. Inevitably, lunch was supposed to be at 1. Inevitably, she would appear at 12:30, and we'd have everything ready to go, basically. And just as we were about to serve, somebody would come in and start talking to her. And she would stand there with a ladle in her hand or a spoon, and even though you were ready to serve and there were 30 people sitting there waiting for Saturday lunch, because she gives people her total attention, lunch would not get served till she stopped having that conversation. So you'd be trying to keep everything hot for maybe half an hour or even an hour while she gave whoever this happened to be her undivided attention. It was very frustrating, I can tell you, having got everything ready on time, to suddenly be, for everything just to completely stop in its tracks. While we were serving lunch, and while she was serving lunch, because she would sort of oversee its serving every day, he would be having a discussion with people at the table. Lunch would often go for 1.5 to 2 hours. It'd start at 1. They often wouldn't get away till 3, or later. This would be a typical Saturday lunch with a lengthy discussion going on around the table. He would be answering people's questions. He almost always ate cold food or hardly ate anything at all when he was there for a meal, because he was just giving his complete attention to whoever happened to be asking the questions. When we'd finally got lunch cleared up Saturday afternoon, Edith and I and whoever else was helping would start working on supper. And at that time, she was still serving supper to everybody. So often in the summer, that was to 100 people. So we were making sloppy joes or pizza for 100 people. That's why you were making so much bread dough in the morning. You were preparing to serve maybe 80 to 100 people every Saturday night. Some sort of simple kind of supper, which you could do in huge amounts like that. Though I can assure you, when you're cooking for that many people, nothing is simple. Absolutely nothing is simple. After supper, every Saturday evening there would be a discussion. There would be other people who weren't even staying for the weekend who would turn up for that Saturday evening discussion. And as I said, there would often be up to 100 people on that crammed into their downstairs living room, out on the stairs, out in the garden outside if the weather was nice, hearing through the windows and through the door. He would encourage people to ask whatever question they wanted to ask. I think as you look back at his ministry, actually his ability to answer questions, his ability in discussing, was the greatest gift that God gave him. The thing that was absolutely immediately obvious in any discussion was his compassion for the people who were asking the questions, his sympathy and understanding, and readiness not to condemn any question or any doubt or any problem that was raised. And one would see some wonderful discussions during these Saturday evening times. When there were masses of people, they'd have them down in the chapel, because you could easily get over 100 people in there for those discussions. But those are some of the things I remember most clearly of my time there, the way he would answer people's questions. And there were almost always non-Christians there asking very, very basic questions. Sunday morning, breakfast would be in the house you happen to be living in. I was living down in Chalet Bethany, so we would have breakfast down there or wherever else we happened to be living. And then there was a church service held in the chapel on Sunday morning, at which Schaefer was usually the person preaching. Of course, for the first many years, he was the only person who was preaching there, but as the church there grew, then other people began to join him in the work of teaching and preaching there. But he would usually preach on Sunday morning, and it was often a sermon there in his own context, which was a good hour in length. They were good long sermons with lots of meat, one may say. As soon as he got back from church, he would dictate to my wife until lunchtime and to tell you how his Sundays went and how hers went too, which used to make me rather annoyed when we were engaged, because it meant we had very little time together on Sundays. But he would dictate to her until lunchtime. Sunday lunch, they would usually have about 30 people that we would have been preparing lunch for on Sundays. They always had a particular practice at Sunday lunch. They would mostly have new people there, people who were there for the weekend, people who'd come up especially for the church service, who would be invited after the church service to have lunch with them. And what their practice on Sunday lunch was always to go around the table and start with people systematically and go around and ask them who they were and where they came from and where they were at. And every one of those accounts that a person gave would always lead to a discussion. This meant that lunch would start at 1 and it often wouldn't finish till 4 or even 4:30. If you've got 30 people and you're really giving each one a chance to say who they are, where they've come from, why they're there, and then having a discussion about some of the things they've come for, some of the questions they have, that took a long lunch. Edith would always make something special for lunch on Sunday. She put such an amount of creative effort into her cooking. If any of you ever have the opportunity to eat in her home, you will get to experience it. She's still the same. I've been to stay with her a couple of times each of the last 2 years, just for a day or two. And even though she's now well into her 70s, she just lavishes attention and affection and concern on you if you go and stay with her, if you go to her home, and she will produce some wonderful meals. That's always the way she was, just putting herself into it completely. Well, you'd think that was enough meals for the weekend. At that time, they were serving tea to everybody on Sundays. Sunday tea was usually between 30 and 50 people, because a lot of people had started leaving who were there just for the weekend, so the numbers went down. But for Sunday tea, she would make and have us help her making all kinds of really dainty little sandwiches and things. Everything, bread just cut so thin, you had to try and get about 40 slices out of a loaf. Not because she was parsimonious, but because she wanted to have bread just wafer thin, so the sandwiches would taste even better. We'd be making cakes and all kinds of things. So she would be serving tea for between 30 to 50 people on every Sunday evening.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, how did
Sunday evening tea wasn't usually a discussion. Sunday evening tea was held down in the living room, and you just sit around casually. for the lunches, even if they had 20 to 30 people there, they would have half a dozen tables crammed into their dining room. There was one big table which sat about a dozen people, and then there were four or five other smaller tables, each with three or four people sitting at them. But everybody was paying attention to the one discussion, to the questions that different people from all over the room were asking him. So it was a meal that was carried on with basically a dialogue. When you had a formal meal like that, for Sunday evening tea, and for Saturday evening when there was up to 100 people, that was just completely informal. People were sitting all over the garden, all over the living room, just chatting in ones and twos and threes around the room. But any sit-down meal at the table, like Sunday lunch or Saturday lunch, always had a formal discussion at it, with just one person speaking at a time so everybody could pay attention to what was being said. What else shall I say about this? As you can imagine, the schedule was very hectic. In the summer, as Edith's cook, as Edith's worker, as Edith's helper and cook, we would do all kinds of extra things as well. I was often up with her. If you were working for her, you kept the same hours that she did. I was just out of college, so I was young and healthy, at least I thought I was, but after about 3 months of it, I was absolutely shattered and was in need of a holiday. I would have to get up before 7 in the morning to get the bread from the baker. We were often up to 1 the next morning, making pickles, making relishes, freezing corn from the garden, just all kinds of things like that. So even after the day was over and you've cooked all these meals for people, there were still other things to do afterwards. I remember, in fact, that summer we were there, there was such a huge crop of green tomatoes and cucumbers from the gardens when the first frost came. We had so much relish, we made it in the bathtub. We made 80 quarts of relish. We had to scrub out the bathtub with bleach to get it absolutely spotlessly clean first, and then we made this huge tub of relish for the Saturday evening suppers in the bathtub. But it was incredibly hard work, I can tell you, trying to keep up with Edith. And to work for her. And as I said, after a couple of months of that, I needed a week's holiday. I had to get away for a little while just to get some sleep and just to try to catch up with my own life. But that gives you some kind of idea of the kind of schedule that they went through. On weekdays, he would spend his time, he would always dictate for several hours every morning. He was amazingly prompt at answering letters. He would try to reply to every letter he received within 2 or 3 days of getting it. And already by this time he was getting a huge correspondence of people who wanted to come, of people who'd been, who were writing to him for help, people he'd met in different places. And by this time too already, various Christian leaders from around the world who would write to ask him for his advice. And Vicky could give you a list. She wouldn't, because it would be a private thing of people she had letters dictated to, but it would be all kinds of people you know from all sorts of different denominations and Christian groups all over the world who were at this time already writing to him for advice and spiritual wisdom. But he would reply so quickly. So he would dictate for hours, and then he would expect those letters to go out either that afternoon or the next day. I mean, once he had them dictated, they had to go. And so working as his secretary was tremendously hard work as well. So he'd spend part of the day dictating. He would spend part of the day at this time working on the manuscripts of The God Who Was There and Escaped from Reason, and he would spend part of the day talking to students who were staying at Labrie. At that time, he was still seeing every person who came through individually to talk to them about their study program, what tapes they were going to listen to, what books they were going to read, what their questions were, and so on. And if the weather was nice, almost every day he'd go for a walk with at least one person somewhere into the hills around there, which are just incredibly beautiful. It really is one of the most beautiful places on earth. If you've ever been there, it is astonishingly beautiful in the Alps there. Just at every season of the year, it's just extraordinarily beautiful. But I just to say all this, just to describe a little bit of what their life was actually like. You know, they were really working hard. There was no way one could doubt their commitment to what they were doing and their commitment to the people who came there. Of course, life there was far from ideal in all kinds of ways. But without any doubt, there was a very substantial demonstration of the effect that the Christian faith has on people's lives, as you saw the way they were giving themselves to that work and to the people who came there. You mentioned earlier you had a book by Elizabeth Elliot. What's it called?
A Chance to Die,
which is dealing with that theme in the Christian life which we talked about before. But the Schaeffers really were a quite dramatic illustration of that, about the preparedness to be like a grain of wheat that falls into the ground and dies in order to bear fruit. And it certainly did bear fruit in the people's lives, because it's that quality of life opens the door to people's minds in a very dramatic way. When people see a substantial demonstration of Christianity being lived, they are so much readier to hear what you have to say and to hear the way you answer their questions. Because human beings really are whole, and the whole of their life is interconnected like that. And when you touch somebody's heart, when you feed their body, they really are much readier to listen to what you have to say.